Hello, this is Jack here. I'm resident scholar at the American Bankruptcy Institute. We're here for another in a series of conversations with bankruptcy professionals in which we try better to understand the system and how they do their work in it. Today's guest has fashioned a dual career for himself. David Lander is a distinguished commercial and bankruptcy lawyer, but in his youth he was a legal aid lawyer, and he's maintained an active interest in issues of consumer bankruptcy policy. David Lander, welcome to ABI Podcasts.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for inviting me.
Yes, David, I believe you told me once that you were a third child and that this factor is supposed to explain something. What does it explain?
Well, it explains, my view is that the first child is the one subject to the greatest pressure in a family. A family has all kinds of notions, and the second child then is sort of caught in the middle. And the third child, by that time, most parents are really tired. And so as a result, they more or less leave you alone. And there's detriments in being left alone by your parents, but the benefit is that you're able to sort of go out and be yourself and with a very small amount of pressure. So I think that that's been a great thing for me.
You know, the days of the week also, like Wednesday's child is full of woe and Thursday's child has far to go.
And we go to the horoscope as well. I mean, we could go a long way with that.
Oh, might as well.
And then we'll go to, you know, then we'll do our genealogy, and then we'll go to our blood type.
All right.
And our DNA.
Look, for a framework, let's review your career here. You're from St. Louis, aren't you?
Yes. I was always been in St. Louis, except 4 years at Bowdoin in Maine and 3 years at the University of Chicago.
Okay. You went to Chicago Law School.
Right.
And in addition to being a third child, I know what always comes up in the conversation is about the University of Chicago is Grant Gilmore. So tell me about Grant Gilmore.
Well, I only have a few heroes in the world, or sheroes, whatever you call them, and he is certainly one. I think that you can never underestimate the effect that an extraordinary teacher, whether it's elementary school, college, law school, has on the minds of people there, even if they never spoke. I never spoke to Professor Gilmore outside of class for a lot of reasons. First of all, I didn't have that much to say to him, and second of all, he was such a genius that I was intimidated, but in class, he spoke to my mind and the minds of others. I attended him for contracts, secured transactions, and in those two courses, my mind and my career have been profoundly affected. A quick vignette on that. About 7 or 8 years ago, Bob Martin, a bankruptcy judge in Madison, and Mary Jo Heston and I did a tour of the state of Washington for beginning CLE programs. We spent a week. We had a wonderful, wonderful time. And Bob and I were not the most studious candidates there at the University of Chicago. I mean, we both did fine, but we weren't the most studious. And yet in this conversation, somehow Gilmore's name came up, and we graduated in 69. So the secured transactions course and the contract course were 67, 68. And Bob and I were each able to recall specific lectures that Professor Gilmore gave, and almost to the point of some of the words he said. I tell my law professor friends, you know, when you get discouraged, realize that you've had wonderful results on people you'll never know. And my life, my career have been profoundly affected. Now, he spoke in a very complicated way, and he had two sets of glasses he wore, and he was a smoker, and he had emphysema. It's very difficult to understand. One time they had a day where you could bring your wives or spouses or whatever, friends, partners, to class, and I remember my wife said she was off that day from working. She said, I'd like to go. You talked about this person ad nauseum. And you don't even care about school at all, and you talk about this professor. You seem to hate the rest of it. So she came up, and at the end of it, she said that really she couldn't understand a word he said. Not intellectually, but just because he was puffing and smoking and changing glasses and all that stuff. So
with a little push-broom mustache, too.
Right, exactly right. So different strokes for different folks. And one of the things that I keep on my library of books is the original two-volume set of Security, Interest, and Personal Property.
Yeah, how about that?
Yeah.
I have one of them, too.
And the other thing about that I think it's important to say, since Gilmore had a PhD in, I think, French literature before he went back to law school, extraordinarily beautifully written stuff, yeah, in addition to just being brilliant.
Good. Boy, that's a great start to have, isn't it?
Yes.
So what did you do after law school?
I was a legal aid lawyer and law school professor for the first 10 years. And my law school teaching had one-piece secured transactions, but mostly was about starting up clinics and working in clinics that the law school sponsored back then. There was Klepper grants that were trying to get all law schools to understand that they needed to have legal services clinics. So started one up at St. Louis U with a good friend, Jesse Goldner, and taught secured transactions and a few other courses. And then betwixt and between that, I was a legal services lawyer and did that for about 10 years. And then needed to, I'd actually been the executive director the final 5 years, which literally drove me crazy. And the administrative stuff made me crazy. But I had a great time, wouldn't trade it for anything. But then I needed to do something different.
Your legal aid practice, did that involve bankruptcy commercial work, or were you doing other stuff?
I was doing other stuff. It did involve consumer work. You know, truth in lending was a big thing. You know, this was ancient history when truth in lending had teeth. And I did a fair amount of public utility work representing low-income consumers.
I guess truth in lending came on about the same time you got out of law school.
It did. My law school classmate, Jack Payer, and Robbie Doxson both went to legal aid in Atlanta when we graduated in 69. It was almost the effective date. And John Payer was the guy who really made the initial major law coming out of the University of Chicago Law School into Atlanta Legal Aid Society.
Mm-hmm.
So for truth in lending lawyers, that was a wonderful time.
Back, as you say, when truth in lending had teeth.
Right.
Implying that it lost its teeth somewhere along the line?
Yes. Oh my goodness. My sense is it was always passed because Senator Douglas was finally going to lead the Senate. Mm-hmm. And they would never pass it while he was there. But I guess they got a couple of additional votes who felt sorry for him. And they passed it. And then the first 6-8 years, the good news was that you could really punish folks. The bad news was that they sometimes got punished for nothing mistakes. So that was strong enough to sort of take all the teeth out of it, really.
Then you went, after your 10 years legal aiding and teaching, you went into private practice then in St. Louis?
I did. I was trying to figure out what to do. I was sort of part of litigator, part of consumer lawyer, new Article 9. Fortunately for me, the new bankruptcy code had just been passed. This was March of 1980, and St. Louis, like most other cities, didn't have a strong business bankruptcy bar. And I've always believed that if you can pick something to do that there's not that many competitors, you can usually do a little bit better. So I took what I knew about Article 9, and I caught up with regard to bankruptcy. The other thing that pushed me into it is among the mistakes that I made at when I was head of legal aid was that when I found a really good lawyer, I just hired her.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you do that enough, that what it means is that you have more expenses than you have revenue.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is, like, you can't pay for the library books and all kinds of things like that. And so what happened was I had great experience in learning what it means to run a financially distressed business.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another piece of the puzzle. I knew what it meant to do all of that. So I thought it was a really good thing to try. In 1980, I decided to try it.
Is that the way you sold yourself to the firm? I'm for you because I know how to run a
business. I had a different script at that time. I'm sure it was equally ridiculous.
Well, you wouldn't be the first guy with the label Chapter 11 consultant on his lapel, but turns out to have been a debtor in possession or something.
Exactly right, but this was 1980, not 2006.
Sure. Did you have a mentor in the bankruptcy practice there at the firm, or did you have to sort of create yourself as a bankruptcy lawyer?
I had to create myself. I think cities like St. Louis really didn't have any sophisticated business bankruptcy practice, and I went to a seminar or two. But actually where I really learned it all was in the farm crisis. I sort of putting on the legal aid hat a little bit again. A couple of farmers came to us, and at that time there was no Chapter 12, so we put them in Chapter
1980s now?
Yeah, early in the 80s, 83, 84, which was a ag depression in the Midwest.
Sure.
And first several years of that, when one farmer realized that, you know, somebody's foreclosure was called off or somebody had to return the equipment that was repossessed.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they all beat a path to our door, and they all desperately needed that. And so, and in those cases, and this was a really great value, you tried every cash collateral matter, mm-hmm. and you tried every confirmation.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll bet you we had, you know, 20 trials of those kinds in the 5-year period.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it was a great way to learn what those complicated provisions really mean. And then, of course, all the plans failed. No, not all of them, but many of them. So then I wrote an article in about, 86 or 88 about post-confirmation, which nobody knew anything about, all because most of my plans failed.
Well, you know, when I was a tad at this business, I assumed that you confirmed the plan, and then that became the law of the case, and life went on as before. And if anybody violated the plan, You might sue on that violation in any court, which might mean state court. But that never happens, does it?
Well, it's a really strange thing what happens after. I mean, we have two worlds, or three worlds actually now. One world is the really big company. The really big company, when they stumble, they refile. And everybody says, great, because there's too many jobs, too much. There's never, if you take a look at all the very large cases that have refiled, there's nobody even files a motion to dismiss. So the law of the land is that if you're a large enough case with a large enough number of employees, you refile with impunity. If you're a little tiny case, really, they don't let you back in no matter what you do. And if you're in the middle and you have extraordinarily changed circumstances, then you can come back in. Now, the vast majority of the middle-sized or small cases, when they fail the second time, the secured creditor just takes it. And really, alternatively, in the slightly bigger cases where you have this wonderful point about the somebody wants to file an involuntary and somebody else files a motion to convert the failed case. And there's one place where the laws, the drafters of the code had a really hard time. But the neat thing is that the judges figured it out. And they took the defective statute, a wonderful statute that was defective on these provisions, and they worked out this wonderful program. And it's even cuter now because, so now there's three groups. There's the very large case that files with impunity. There's the middle-sized and small case that usually don't get in unless it's ridiculously changed circumstances. And then there's some new rules in the new statute for certain kinds of, I think it's small business cases or individual cases that fail.
We're kind of a de facto small business chapter, even though it doesn't have that name, don't it?
Yes.
So that was the farm SAG of the 1980s. What's your practice been like since then? You're not still doing farm cases?
No, it's been it's probably a third debtor and two-third creditor, probably 75% outside the bankruptcy court, you know, workouts and those kinds of things, and then 25% in. In St. Louis, we have mostly middle-sized cases. We get in some of the larger cases in other venues and occasionally get one here in St. Louis. So I'd say it's middle-sized and large cases. We're really very lucky that we do some debtor work and some secured creditor work.
Let me see if I can struggle to make sense out of a point here. Back when the code was new, I was taught that Chapter 11 was about giving old equity owners an extra bite at the apple and a chance to try to salvage something on their equity stake. And these days you hear people, perhaps including me, who say that that kind of case just doesn't exist anymore, that Chapter 11 is there to maximize liquidation values for secured creditors, and if equity gets something, well, that's just good fortune, but it's not really about equity anymore. Does that fit your experience? Or?
Well, it does in some ways with one caveat. I mean, if the march, you know, I call it Chapter 363, not Section 363, because if you look at the percentage of cases over the last 6 or 8 years that have said, how do we get this, you know, cleaner to sell and use the court for that, and generally to benefit just the secured creditor, but occasionally a few others. That's the march has been extraordinary that way. You still see
under Section 363 of the bankruptcy.
Yes. I mean, it could conceivably under the plan, but almost always under Section 363 of the bankruptcy code. The other piece, though, that I think is an interesting one. The last several years is that if you have a two big folks fighting, and that is maybe it's the sub debt, maybe it's somebody who came in, an investor who came in at the junk bond level. They've, in a sense, replaced the equity in what you said at the beginning, because they put up all kinds of barriers and basically say, if you want us out of the way, then this is what you have to pay us. So there's some of that. I mean, there's a few of the old cases still around, but I'd say the percentage of them is maybe down to 15%, and it's made it less fun.
I got that. How much claims trading changed the way you practice law, the way you do Chapter 11 cases?
Oh, there's no question about that. The claims trading has, as money looks for different places to be invested and to go, and the money has found the purchase of claims in these cases, you never know what group is going to be infiltrated with someone different, either an entirely different group, maybe they're just investors, or a significantly different group. And many times the people buying the claims then are other players in the same industry or a related industry. So they look on that play there as a way of influencing the result, getting control. And I think it's made the lives of the party, particularly debtor's life, significantly more complicated.
My impression is that in the old days, you'd go to your creditors and say, now, look, gang, both ends of the boat are sinking, and you're our suppliers, and you need us as much as we need you, and we can work together on that basis. And if you're dealing with the arbitrager who bought the claim, you don't have that kind of motivation.
There's no question about it. Now, the good news in all these pieces is that I think I like new and creative things, and I know you do, Jack. That's how we've met over the years. And the good thing about all this is that the practice isn't going to be in 5 years where it is right now. And so you begin to see some things that are happening, and then they may or may not become the trend. So the good news is that this business and the use of Chapter 11 is constantly evolving.
Yeah, I can't let that one pass. Where is the practice going to be 5 years from now?
Well, the practice, I guess the practice is going to continue to get extraordinarily bifurcated with these, just as I said, with the post-confirmation stuff, with a whole set of rules for the very large case, and then sort of everything else. And the large cases are going to continue, in my view, to all be in New York and Delaware and a very small number around the rest of the country. And then most of the rest of the courts are going to be dealing with middle-sized cases, some interesting, some not. I think, if the pendulum swing notion works, then the rest of the world is already adopting the RO Chapter 11. And so maybe we'll see some kind of a swing back to cases where the secured creditors don't have it exert their control solely for selling. I mean, these cases are being sold because that's the financial incentive that most people think is best, the people that control the case. I mean, the reason Chapter 11 lives, particularly in these big cases, is all the various groups see the financial benefit. So it's cute that, when we went through this last change, which was devastating to consumer bankruptcy, we didn't have hardly any of the tiny little change on the business bankruptcy side, primarily because the major players are not dissatisfied.
Mm-hmm. Good. Let me, one more. I'm curious about, I said we want to get back to consumer cases sooner or later, but roll-ups, the phenomenon, I guess, in the 90s and the 2000s, where no matter how shabby the business was, it seems to me, you'd find some outside money man that would come in and say, look, I'll give you money just for the privilege of taking over the business and rolling it into my nationwide chain of, I don't know, tow truck operators, or I guess if you watch 6 Feet Under, they were rolling up funeral homes. Are roll-ups part of your Chapter 11 life now, or am I off on a wild goose chase?
Well, you still see them. I mean, you still see them, because the question becomes, what is the entrepreneur making money with? Mm-hmm. Well, to give a comparison, years ago, when bowling was a big thing, so if a town could take 4 bowling alleys, you built 10, and then you rolled it back. If a you see this in so many of these different industries, tennis courts, the same thing. In a sense, you saw it with catfish farms, okay? So lenders need to lend money. I mean, that's what they're selling. That's their product. Entrepreneurs and developers, non-real estate developers, need to figure out new kinds of businesses that they can make bigger. Well, so you'd then say, let's take the dry cleaning business or whatever it is. Let's take the used car business, whatever it is. Let's find another arena or another venue for taking development skills, borrowed debt, and equity dollars that are looking for a place, and let's do that. Then, of course, a few work, but many don't. And then what you do is you drain out all the extra debt, and that's what Chapter 11 is good at. And if the idea was any good in the first place, then what you do once the debt's drained out, then you have something that works. And I'm not sure you could. It's an odd way of getting there, because there's a fair amount of loss involved. But I'm not sure that there's a more direct route in a capitalist society.
Well, they need J.P. Morgan to take him out on his yacht and say, "Now look, boys, there isn't room enough for 2 railroads in this country, so you're going to have to get together and decide on one."
Exactly right. Or one of you is going to be tipped over to side, and we don't know which.
Yeah. My dad was a credit manager. He used to say that every restaurant gets sold 3 times before the capital cost gets down low enough that you can cover it somehow.
Oh, it's true, and that's why I mentioned the catfish farm piece. I mean, there's whole industries that you couldn't afford to build through traditional equity and debt notions. Uh-huh. So we get there by building them, putting all those extra dollars in, and then flushing them out.
We'll be back after a short break.
We pause. pause this week's podcast to bring you bankruptcy in the news. Cable TV companies Time Warner and Comcast won bankruptcy court approval Tuesday to buy Adelphia Communications for $17.6 billion in cash and stock. Judge Robert E. Gerber approved the sale without a creditor vote more than 14 months after Time Warner and Comcast agreed to buy the assets. Approval was slowed by fighting among Adelphia creditors over how to distribute proceeds to repay more than $18 billion in debts. Adelphia had been in talks with creditors and bondholders for several months about the sale to Time Warner and Comcast. In May, it asked Judge Gerber to allow the sale to proceed without approval of its reorganization plan. The last remaining hurdle for the Adelphia sale is approval by the Federal Communications Commission. Last week, FCC Chairman Kevin Martin said he expected the agency to complete its review of the deal by mid-July. If approved by the FCC, the deal would transfer Adelphia's 5 million subscribers to the two cable giants, who will share the bankrupt operator's cable system's assets. This has been John Hartgen of the ABI. Thank you for listening, and now back to this week's podcast.
I know we want to talk about consumer stuff. You were involved in consumer law at the beginning of your career, and it sounds like you may have been interested in that from the time you came out of law school. Am I right on that?
Yeah, I sure was. And didn't exactly know how to make a living with it until the legal aid lawyer really worked out well. It's extraordinarily more difficult to figure out how to make a career as a consumer debtor lawyer on the debtor or plaintiff side than is on the other side.
Tell me more about that. What drew you to consumer law in the first place?
Well, I guess what drew me to consumer law is sort of the following, that it's my view that whenever a vulnerable person has money in their pocket, there's somebody trying to take it. So it goes back to when I was at a young legal aid lawyer. There was a program that helped poor people get into houses. It's called Section 235. And what I realized after working at it for years is these consumers had the opportunity to borrow umpteen thousands of dollars to put into a house. So what happened then is all kinds of folks said, well, wait a minute, how can I get those dollars out of their pocket? You know, because that's a lot of money, $25,000 back then, times umpteen people. It's a lot of money to be made. So my view was and is that as long as vulnerable people have money, somebody's going to be looking to take it away from them. And that's sort of another rule of capitalism. And some of them are illegal ways, and some of them are legal ways, and some of them are just shady but legal ways. So the beauty of legal services back then, and now, although the funding is much, much worse now, the beauty of it was that you could sit and you could think through and work with your vulnerable clients. Didn't mean they weren't smart. Didn't mean they weren't good people. It just were vulnerable in these particular transactions. And you could say, I can use my lawyer skills. And then, of course, the other side never expected the vulnerable person to have a lawyer. So then you really did infuse and empower the consumer in some wonderful ways.
Now, you've maintained an interest in consumer cases all through your practice years. Am I right on that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Do you represent institutional consumer creditors?
No, I've been really lucky. Now, that's not to say the firm I practice does defense work in class action. So I guess the answer is when those folks are sued, sometimes we do. But been extremely fortunate and, as I said, just completely lucky that the firms I've worked at have not played those roles. So I haven't had to have that dilemma. I did have a terrible dilemma at the end of the farm credit, the farmer stuff, because my clients weren't paying their bills and the farm credit system came and said, would you be our lawyer?
Uh-huh.
And I ended up doing it. I ended up making that terrible compromise. But back to the consumer stuff. No, I've been extremely, and I don't even actually represent that many consumers. What I've been able to do is sort of structure a piece that as a professor, as a consultant, as a board member of the consumer credit or as a gadfly in the consumer credit counseling industry, and as a supporter of outstanding consumer debtor lawyers, I've been able to devote a fair amount of time and attention and take my other bankruptcy skills and say, you know, what are some things that I could do to support the efforts of the folks really fighting the battles?
And I've developed a course. Have you done professing all these years? Or?
Yeah, I've taught full-time for 2 years, but I've taught part-time, you know, most of the other 35 years or so since I graduated law school, and got a little bored a few years ago of teaching bankruptcy and Article 9, and through an American Bar Project, we did a survey and realized that virtually no law schools have advanced consumer bankruptcy courses. They all have advanced Chapter 11 courses, not all, but many of them, taught by an adjunct or a judge. So went about to create such a course and stumbled into a really wonderful field of, what has the explosion in consumer credit done to our society and our economy, of which bankruptcy is an important part, but a small part.
Now, it sounds to me what you're describing there would be a perfectly good liberal arts course. I don't know, I bite my tongue as I say that or something of this sort.
Well, you have to be careful when you say that. I just spoke to a group of consumer protection law school teachers in Houston at a great conference they have down there, and was on a program with other people that teach consumer protection courses and trying to sell them on my course. Uh-huh. And I talked to somebody who had tried to sell a similar kind of course in another field, and she said the main thing, and I was going to say, you could teach this as a college course or sociology or an economics. She said, bite your tongue. Because when you talk to law school teachers, you have to say this is a unique course just for the law school. Mm-hmm. So in that grouping, I would say that. However, the materials we're putting together, I'm hoping that they can be put together in a way that an offshoot of that can be, it's a perfect undergraduate course, it's a perfect sociology course, it's a perfect economics course, a perfect business school course. So
many people have found that the best way to teach something in law school is just not tell the dean what you're doing. He's got so much else on his plate, he won't notice, and you just go ahead and do it.
No question. If you're a full-time person, that's harder for an adjunct, because you call it a seminar, you can do that, but usually they say, well, has this been through the curriculum committee?
Yeah, it's not been passing quite as fast.
Right.
So let's talk about the bankruptcy, abuse, protection, or what? And I don't have it right yet, do I?
Well, yeah, they didn't get it right, so why should you?
Abuse Protection Act, yes.
Right.
The 2005 Bankruptcy Amendment.
Yeah, that's what I've always called it.
Yeah. Were you part of the run-up to 2005?
In a couple of ways I was. I was fairly involved in the Bankruptcy Review Commission stuff a few years ago, before that. And some of that became... at least the debate.
To put up a set of recommendations.
Right. Right. And there was a dissent on the consumer side, and there was a back and forth on the consumer side and in their report that in some ways is the beginning of the run-up, not the majority report, but the minority report. Then as things got hot, I enlisted in the effort, in the futile effort to try to get rid of some bad stuff.
So you've had, at least as an interested observer now, we've had I'm counting on my fingers, several months now to observe the 2005 amendments.
Right.
How's life? How are things going on?
Well, not exactly as predicted in some ways and exactly as predicted in others. I mean, the way I take the bill, from the consumer point of view and then the creditor point of view, the consumer debtor lawyers initially were frightened. And it slowed them down and made them charge more. So that plus a bunch of other barriers just create a much higher wall for a consumer debtor to get over it. And I don't think it even has much to do with the means test. It really has to do, except that the means test requires a lot more paperwork. Mm-hmm. So I think where the creditors have been extremely successful, and time will tell on this, but... they've just made it much more expensive and much more complicated to file. And therefore, they have delayed or defeated, maybe delayed filings a lot, and eliminated, at least for now, a significant number of filings. So I think on that piece, it's a complete success for the creditors.
This huge spasm of filings just before October of 75.
And that was their astounding defeat. That's the cute thing. You take a look at the bank profits, financial institution profitability, and they completely underpredicted what the roll-up would be now. So that run-up in those couple of quarters was astounding. And probably all kinds of people, maybe you didn't even need bankruptcy,
sure,
wouldn't have filed it. So they had that tremendous defeat before. But And there's going to be a lot of interesting statutory stuff, you know. Do you say what they, does the court apply what they said or what they meant? And this is kind of a cute thing because it has everything upside down. And that battle is going on many places right now, and that is the judges who say, well, this is what they said, and it's plain language, and I'm going to apply it, and it helps the consumer. Mm-hmm. And you have other judges saying, well, wait a minute, you know they meant to hurt the consumer, and that's ridiculous. So that's going to play out, and effective consumer debtor lawyers are going to poke holes in many, many, many provisions. I have no doubt about that.
Because I've heard the view that the rule of statutory interpretation is that you follow the letter of the law unless it seems to favor the consumer, and then you look at its intent.
That's a good one. The judges are in a complicated place in those things, and you know, some of them are complaining about it, some of them are just carrying out the law. I guess my sense is, so you had this run-up with a huge number of practices. Now, in the last 7 months or 8 months, we have much lower numbers. I believe that they were billed because I think that what these barriers do is delay people. One of the things you've seen in the last few months is, starting in January, a significant increase in the number of people going to consumer credit counseling services, mm-hmm. Which means that, look, there's a huge amount of distress out there. Exacerbated even by the changes and the increase in the minimum payments and some other things, people can only borrow so much against their houses to keep things going, and particularly as we see what happens with interest rates. So what you're going to have is you have as much as distress as you did before. In my view, those people all needed bankruptcy, or the vast majority of them. They still need it. I'm hoping that after some months, the consumer debtor bar gets more comfortable with the software that's out there, with the other protection, and open their doors a little bit. I think Congress is considering a bankruptcy filing fee increase right now, which will just add on more dollars. So I don't know when. I guess a fair number of distressed people who would have filed bankruptcy are just giving up. But more of them are just hanging on and taking a few last gasps and will still need to file it. From the creditor's point of view, so one thing is, okay, so there were a lot, too many beforehand, and then very few. One cute effect, and I don't think that they never cared about this that much, but clearly the credit card folks are never going to get any money out of this, because the car lenders, you know, snuck in and basically changed the rules so you couldn't write down the value of a car in Chapter 13, and therefore, whatever few dollars there were that the unsecured creditors were going to get are going to go to the car creditor. So I don't think it was ever about that. The credit counseling requirement is another barrier. Now, you know, there's folks who say, and there's some studies.
Let's talk about credit counseling, because you know a lot about that industry. And so help us understand consumer credit counseling in general.
Sure. Started 40 years ago for two reasons. One reason was to discourage bankruptcies. And another reason was to help people. So you have these competing goals started by the consumer credit industry, mostly manned early with their employees or their volunteers, separate corporations around, sleepy industry for many, many years. Then when when usury rates went out and eventually the financial institutions realized how much money they could make lending to high-risk consumers, and when investors realized what a return they could get, and securitization was developed, and so you have a huge amount of capital coming, then you have an amazing amount of credit available. So then, of course, people borrow, then they get in trouble, then all of a sudden they need consumer credit counseling way more than they did before. So they start increasing extraordinarily, maybe in the 90s. Well, then what happens is, of course, in a capitalistic society, people see money to be made, so a bunch of charlatans and thieves and crooks and ne'er-do-wells and maybe some okay-minded people, they say, how can we get in on the act? So then basically they're great business people, so they steal all the clients away from the legitimate folks. So then the legitimate, and then in the middle of all this, the creditors say, what have we created here? We've got a lot of crooks in this business, number one. And number two, the way that the industry was basically financed was that, like a collection agency, that the credit card companies kicked back 15% or gave 15% fair share of what they collected back to the agencies. So they said, now this is getting to be a real big number. We have to cut it back. So they started cutting back. So you had about 10 years of complete turmoil in the industry. Luckily, some attorney generals and some others in Congress and the IRS said how we put the crooks out of business, and they've put a good number of the biggest crooks out of business. There's still some in the field. So now you have a few crooks, but then you have some legitimate players who basically do two things. One is they try to give advice, budgeting advice. You know, here's tear up your credit cards and start spending within your limits. And secondly, they have a special thing called a debt management plan, which is like a Chapter 13 with 100% payment to unsecured creditors, no effect on secured creditors. And that's really the product that the credit counseling industry sells. So you have those folks. Now, the problem is that even the best of legitimate ones are not excellent in their either their education or their behavior change for the people that need it through counseling. So you have actually an extraordinarily complicated time, and I'll get to the bankruptcy bill in a second right now, because it may be that IRS puts them all out of business or basically tells them all none of them can be 501c3.
Somebody seems to want to do that, don't they?
Well, right, and that may be happening. We don't know yet. But then the bankruptcy code comes in and says, okay, everybody's got to go to a credit counselor before they file and have a counseling session and get some education after they file and before they're discharged. Now, the good news is that when the U.S. trustee took over this program, they really only let legitimate players in. So they did a great job in screening out most of the really bad guys. But it was an early crisis because many pro se debtors didn't get this counseling certificate before they filed, and that then really messed them up because their cases were dismissed, and then they were hurt by the, you were dismissed once, so you don't get the benefit of the stay. Now that's not happening so much because people know what's going on, and there's some rules they're putting into place to reduce that effect. So I don't know. Nobody knows. The Consumer Federation of America National Consumer Law Center did a report a couple of years ago. They're still highlighting the issue, trying to make sure that, for example, in the bankruptcy debtor education program, that these folks don't charge people who can't pay. Because if they charge them more than they can pay and they go away, then they can never file.
Well, I guess I've heard, and help me on this, that the legit consumer credit counseling agencies are saying, you know, the way we make our money is by doing debt management programs. And BAPCA is forcing on us all these people who will never be eligible for a debt management program. So all we're seeing these days is lost leaders.
That's exactly right. They had thought that the creditors were going to kind of bail them out by giving grants, uh-huh. which they kind of promised. But and they made some small grants, but they sort of backed away from that. Now, the way the credit counseling industry has reorganized and restructured is that there's several gigantic players for whom these still can be lost leaders because you know they're keeping control of the industry, but they are probably losing a few bucks on this program. So they either have to charge more or shorten the programs down the road.
The other thing I've picked up, which I'd be glad for some help on, is I've heard it said that you know they may lose their the illegit, shall we say, may lose their tax-exempt status, but they may continue as nonprofits.
Yeah, that's the most interesting issue right now, which is that if they lose the 501c3, then they have two choices. They could stay as nonprofits, state nonprofits. They continue as state nonprofits without 501c3. And the cute thing is there that they may be really under the radar screen then, because if you do 501c3, there are ways that people can find out about you. But we're not sure, the consumer movement's not sure that if you're a state nonprofit, not 501c3. But the other piece on that is that what some of them are doing is just going for profit. Now, that has two negative effects today. One is that, for the most part, the creditors won't send fair share to, or whatever they call fair share. Some of them are now giving grants, city and others. And the second is that some states require 501c3 to be in this business. Some require only nonprofit. And some require neither. For example, in the there was just a model credit counseling statute approved by the National Council of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, and it has the option for profit or not for profit. So what the for profit credit counseling industry is doing, the trade association, is trying to lobby with some success states to change their law and allow for profits, so that you'll have these three groups: 501c3s, nonprofits, and for-profits. Now, the for-profits will not be able to be part of BACTA, but they don't care. I mean, they seem to think that with their advertising and the other things, that they can make money either way. So a couple of years ago, Consumer Federation of America and NCLC, National Consumer Law Center, did a great study. It's time for another one, because it is conceivable. What IRS is saying is that if most of what you do is debt management plans, then you don't belong, you're not an eligible 501c3. And that's a that's further than the consumer lobby. The consumer lobby group says this. It says, look, there's a lot of people in financial distress who don't want to file bankruptcy. They need some place to go. A couple of million are going to go every year to this industry. So what we have to do is strengthen that industry and give them somebody pretty good to go to, or maybe even somebody excellent to go to. Well, so far that's not happening.
Are you clear what it is that the credit counselors would gain by remaining as nonprofits if they did not have tax-exempt status?
Yes, one thing they would gain is that they would gain the entry to those states who have statutes that say you must be nonprofit.
Okay.
I'm not really sure, and I haven't looked back, but in this regard, whether they can still be, whether they have to have 501c3 or just nonprofit to be an authorized credit counseling agency under BACRA. I just can't remember right this second.
Look, this is wonderful, but, you know, I could do it all night, but we may have lost some of our listeners at this point. We'll probably be able to wrap it up. But, David Lenda, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you, Jack.
Take care.
Take care.
You've been listening to one of a series of podcasts that we are producing here at the American Bankruptcy Institute to help us all understand better how bankruptcy professionals do their work. We hope you found it helpful. Look on our webpage at abiworld.org for more podcast choices. This is Jack here saying thank you for listening.